All right, this is session four, and it's part two of the last part, dealing with Sheol. Here's the plan of attack. Obviously, we're looking at the Hebrew scriptures and the use of the word, the Hebrew word Sheol, and the technique we're using is called procedure of usage, and this is where we actually look at the text, where the word occurs, and we look to see if that text provides us with additional understanding about the word in the context of the text. That's what that is about. So it's always about the context of the text when you're doing procedure of usage. We've already covered what happened at Endor and the exceptions of Enoch and Elijah, if they were exceptions. If they're not exceptions, if they were exceptions, it doesn't matter, but we did cover them. So what we're going to pick up now is we're going to do some figurative parables. Of course, we have to talk about Yeshua. And then, as I told you last time, we're going to, at the end of this presentation, there's a patriarchal alert that will be issued. There's a patriarch missing in action, and we will address that at the end of this presentation. Here's a review. What have we learned so far? The dead know nothing. Their thoughts come to an end. The body becomes dust again. The spirit has departed and is back with God. There's no expressions of emotion. The small and the great are there. The wicked cease from troubling. The weary are at rest. Prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor because they have no ears. Servants are free from their masters. One lies in Sheol until the heavens be no more. During their stay in Sheol, that sounds like stay in a motel, they will not awake nor be aroused out of their sleep. I did add this because if Yahweh calls, I will hear his voice and answer. We saw the testimony of Moses. Moses died, Moses was called, Moses made an appearance. We've got scriptures to support that. Okay, figurative parables. The first one is Ezekiel 31. Now some of these are three sets here. I'm going to talk a little bit more detail about the Isaiah text. This is why I sent this out to you, so you could read it within the context of what's going on. I have tried to do some translation to assist in what is going on behind the scenes so that you can understand. While the history here is really interesting and the design of the text is really interesting, there's a lot of interesting stuff here. I do not want to get lost in the things that are interesting. I just want to mention them and present the fact that this word, Sheol, appears in these texts. And we're going to see what the text says, and we're going to compare it to what we've already learned and find out that it doesn't agree. So then we have to deal with that. So let's start. This particular one is an oracle relating to what I called improper haughtiness. Yahweh had raised up a nation by his own hand, and that nation forgot him and therefore had to be brought down. This oracle was told from the standpoint of comparison. Think about that, comparison. Contrast might even be a better word. Whereby another nation that was greater had been brought down in the past, so this specific nation will experience the same thing. So remember that what is being presented is a bigger picture of the contrast of a situation. Continuing my overview, in the eyes of Judah, Egypt was a giant power. They hoped that they could help them starve off Babylonian pressure. Of course, we, looking back, know that that didn't happen. This oracle attempts to undermine the confidence of Ezekiel's contemporaries. That is the most key point of this entire thing. Ezekiel is writing to Judah. Even though he's not, he is. This is to undermine the confidence of Judah in the power of Pharaoh. Okay? And I'm going to try to remember to restate that as we go through here. This oracle attempts to undermine the confidence of Ezekiel's contemporaries by contrasting Egypt's greatness with a nation who was greater, but now lies in ruins. There's your contrast comparison theme again. And here is what you need to know. If Assyria could fall, so could Egypt. That's what we're dealing with. All right, let's start looking at the text. To some degree, I have filled in some information, also tried to make the text a little more clear to read. So if you have a problem with my translation, then just let me know. We'll see if we can work through it. It came to pass in the 11th year, in the third month, in the first day of the month, that the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, okay, I put in, if you don't know that this has to do with the carrying away of the king, it's like, well, what is the 11th year in the third month and the first day? What are we talking about here? But if you have a chronological timeline that you can link it to, then you know, oh, this is taking place right then. Ah, so that's why I added that for you. Verse 2, Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude, to whom of your class can you fitly be compared to by an objective beholder? The answer, which isn't in the text, but I'm telling you ahead of time, the answer is to another great king greater than you, but nonetheless fell. That's the unspoken answer here to this rhetorical question. Verse 3, consider Assyria, once a cedar in Lebanon. Do we really believe that the nation of Assyria was once a tree? Realign your thinking. This is not a literal thing to be understood. Assyria was never a tree. Okay? With beautiful branches overshadowing the forest, it towered on high, its top above the thick foliage. The waters of the Tigris, I put that in so you know what waters we're talking about, nourished it. Deep springs made it grow tall. Their streams flowed all around its base and sent their channels to all the trees of the field. If we were actually studying this passage, I would break down this text to tell you what each one of them meant from a military perspective, but it's outside the scope. But just understand, we're talking about a tree parable. It towered higher than all the trees of the field. Its boughs increased and its branches grew long, spreading because of abundant waters. All the birds of the air nested in its boughs. All the beasts of the field gave birth under its branches. All the great nations lived in its shade. You know it doesn't mean all, right? It ain't all. I can assure you that the polar bears in Alaska did not travel down to Assyria to give birth and then travel back to Alaska. I'm going to put money on that. Okay? So just understand the context of what is taking place here. It was majestic in beauty, with its spreading boughs, burrows, whatever that word is, for its roots extended to many waters. The cedars, are you ready? The cedars in the garden of God could not rival it. Now, what do we know about creation? It was good. It was good. It was very good. Oh, but it wasn't good enough. Because the cedars in the garden of God rivaled this tree. What's being said here? Think about contrast. Think about metaphorism. Nor could the pine trees equal its boughs. Nor could the chestnut trees compare with its branches. No tree in the garden of God could match its beauty. Who is this to? People who know about the Garden of Eden. Judah. They know the story. And remember, what are we trying to do? Undermine their confidence in a foreign power. Because instead of taking the authority of the Almighty and letting Him be the king or the one who was guiding you, we're going to take our allegiance and put it into this foreign power over here. Yahweh made it beautiful. It actually says, I made it beautiful, with abundant branches. The envy of all the trees of Eden. Come on now. Do you really think that the trees in the Garden of Eden were experienced the emotion of envy over the Assyrian nation 4,000 years later? Therefore, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. Because it is high in stature, and it has set its top among the clouds, and its heart is haughty in its loftiness, and I put in here the pride of the affluent who forgot God, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of a mighty one of the heathen, for him to deal with according to their wickedness. I cast it aside, and the most ruthless of foreign nations cut it down and left him prostrate. Think about that. Cut a tree down, left it laying on the ground. Its boughs fell on the mountains and in all the valleys. Its branches lay broken in all the ravines of the land. All the nations of the earth came out from under its shade and left it. Desertion. All the birds of the air settled on the fallen tree. and all the beasts of the field were among its branches. Therefore, no other trees by the waters are ever to tower proudly on high, lifting their tops above the thick foliage. No other trees so well watered are ever to reach such a height. They are all destined for death, for the earth below, among mortal men who go down to the pit. Looks like we have changed a little bit here. 15. This is what the Sovereign Yahweh says. On the day Assyria was brought down to Sheol, I caused mourning for him. Assyria was greater than the Garden of Eden in this tree parable. And the trees in the Garden of Eden experienced envy over this. I caused mourning for him. As mourners cover their heads in a token of mourning, I covered the deep springs for him. I held back its streams, and its abundant waters were restrained. I caused Lebanon to mourn for him, and all the trees of the field fainted for him. Still not nothing literal here. I made the nations to shake at the sound of his fall, when I brought him down to Sheol with those who go down to the pit. We'll talk about this passage again, but I just want to bring to your attention. I made the nations to shake at the sound of the cedars falling, which would be the nations outside who are looking at the greatness of Assyria, and then when Assyria is taken down by the Almighty, they're like, whoa. Then all the trees of Eden, the choicest and best of Lebanon, all the trees that were well watered, were comforted in the earth. The trees, let's take it again, trees of Eden, the choice and the best of Lebanon, the trees that were well watered, were comforted in the earth below. What are we talking about? The figure of speech here is we're using trees to talk about nations. They were comforted in the earth below because so great a king as the Assyrian was brought down to their level. 17. They also went down into Sheol with him. Everybody's going down to Sheol, it appears. That is, those that had been killed with the sword. Those who were allied militarily. Think about it. Go back to the beginning. What did I say? We are putting forth a story to be submitted to Judah, who wants to ally themselves militarily with Pharaoh of Egypt, when Assyria had allies that were militarily involved with them. When Yahweh took down Assyria, he took down those that were allied with him. Therefore, if you ally yourself with Pharaoh and I take down Pharaoh, what's going to happen to you, Judah? That's what this verse is saying. I know it's convoluted, but I didn't write this. I'm just telling you what I'm understanding, okay? They also went down to Sheol with him. That is, those that had been killed with the sword and those who were allied militarily, having therefore enjoyed his protection among the nations. What does that mean? If you were to form an alliance with Assyria, then to some degree Assyria would look out for your interests, probably when it benefits their interests, but text doesn't say that, but I'm just saying. All right, 18. Which of the trees of Eden, this is the summary statement, which of the trees of Eden can be compared with you in splendor and majesty? It's rhetorical. So that's why there's no answer listed. Yet you too will be brought down with the trees of Eden to the lowest parts of the earth below. You will lie among the uncircumcised with those killed by the sword. Who are we talking about? This is Pharaoh and all his hordes, declares Sovereign Yahweh. So what has happened here? Judah, let me tell you a story. There was a nation that was great and mighty, and I built them up, and I did this, and I did that, and I did something else, and they were great. Then they became prideful, and I had to take them down. And everybody that was allied with them, I took down with them, and I stuffed them all in Sheol. So, you might want to consider again whether or not you want to become allied militarily with Pharaoh, because I'm letting you know right now, I'm taking Pharaoh down too. So make your choice. Here we go. That's what we got. This is what this is talking about here. All right, let's continue. Here's 18 again. All that has been said of the Assyrian, consider as said to thyself, Pharaoh. To whom art thou so like as thou art to the Assyrian? None. Thus saith the sovereign Yahweh, Pharaoh's end shall be the same humiliating one as I have depicted the Assyrians to have been. It's an interesting approach that our Heavenly Father took. He was trying to let them know that the decision they're about to make is a bad one. Somewhat convoluted, but you can see how he's using this. Let's look back. The overthrow of Egypt is illustrated by that of Assyria, a greater nation, using a tree parable, or tree story. Yahweh instructs Ezekiel to speak to Judah about the Pharaoh. Say to Pharaoh, who can be compared with you in majesty, let's consider Assyria, who was a greater nation. Yahweh describes the greatness of Assyria using figurative terms about trees. Yahweh made it beautiful to the envy of all the trees in Eden. Once again, not to be understood literally. In its heart, Assyria became proud because of how great it had become. Therefore, Yahweh delivered Assyria over to her enemies so that her iniquity could be dealt with. She was completely cast aside. Brought her down to Sheol. I made the nations to shake at the sound of your fall when she was brought down. And the key statement, I also sent down to Sheol those who were militarily allied with her. So, in this passage, you can see that the word Sheol takes place. And you know what we've already seen from all of the other scriptures we've looked at. In this thing here, there is the appearance of a consciousness in Sheol when these events take place. The trees are conversing, kind of like Judges 9, I think, where the trees are looking for a leader. And so they talk to the bushes and the flowers and some other things. And finally, somebody agrees to lead the trees. Probably not a literal application. So what we have here is not really anything that is causes us to take everything else that we have looked at and turn it upside down. This is just one. But I'm going to give you another one. So we're going to strengthen the case. And the next one, of course, is 32. Chant a poem of bereavement. Here's the Hebrew word. The noun represents a poem which is chanted or sung. It is to be distinguished from other types of mourning, because other types of mourning is a different Hebrew word. This particular one deals with chanting or singing out something. This is not something you see a lot today, as far as I know. All the funerals I've been to, I've never seen somebody there chanting. Now, there probably are some that do that, but I just haven't been to them. This lamentation was sung prophetically of impending death or destruction. This Hebrew word is used when there is impending death or destruction. So that is a key for us right there. Something is getting ready to happen. This Hebrew word says chant. And this last line here is from a theological word book of the Old Testament. Here we go. It came to pass in the 12th year, in the 12th month, the first day. Okay, that's a year and a half later. Once again, you have to know about the king and the carrying away of the king, so you have a chronological line to work with. So this is a year and a half later. The word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, chant a poem of bereavement concerning Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, You are like a lion among the nations. You are like a crocodile of the Nile in the seas, thrashing about in your streams, churning the water with your feet, and muddying the streams. Thus says Sovereign Yahweh, I will cast over thee the nets of many nations. Okay, what do we have here? Pharaoh is not really a lion. And he's not really a crocodile. His nation is not a lion or a crocodile. So we have another figurative approach to understanding what the Almighty is going to do. He's going to cast over thee the nets of many nations. What does that mean? Does that mean that all these different nations have nets and they're going to go hunt crocodiles in the Nile? Probably not. That's not what it's talking about here. And will bring thee up with my hook. I will leave you on the land. What happens? I put this in parentheses. As a fish drawn out of water loses all its strength. What happens when you take it and put it on the land? That's what the Almighty is going to do. And hurl you onto the open field. I will cause all the birds of the heavens to settle on you, and all the beasts of the earth to gorge themselves on you. I've highlighted gorge because when I think of the word gorge on flesh, I'm thinking that probably the carcass is dead. That's what I'm thinking. I will spread your flesh on the mountains and fill the valleys with your remains. I will water the land. What was the Nile known for? Watering the land so that all the good things come up. I will water the land with your blood, and I will make it reach to the mountains. So we have a reversal of fortune, in a sense here. 7. When I snuff you out, this was a tough sentence to translate because of the figurative speech here. When I snuff you out, Pharaoh, you as a bright star, Pharaoh's not a star, but just follow the text, as a bright star, when I extinguish you from the political landscape of all these other nations, the going out of your light, all of the world is going to recognize that, whoa, a big one has been taken out. That's what this passage is saying. I went and really looked at the Hebrew on this text, and I was like, wow, this is tough. Anyway, so this is the best that I could come up with in verse 7. Verse 8. All the shining lights in the heavens I will darken over you and set darkness over your land. 9. I will trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring about your destruction among the nations into the lands which you have not known. So what is going to happen here? When this great kingdom is brought down by the Almighty, other people are going to hear about it. I mean, you can even see that in Rahab. I think one of her comments was, the people around here have seen what is going on with your God, and they're all kind of scared. So word travels. And so Yahweh is going to make sure it does. Into lands which you have not known. Verse 10, I will cause many people to be astonished at you, and their kings shall be utterly amazed when my sword flies in their faces as they wait for their own fall from the day they hear of your fall. All right, so now we're talking about all of these people that are in allegiance. The Almighty is going to go after all of them. This is going to happen first. They're going to hear about it. They're going to be terrified. Then I'm taking them down too. 11. For this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. The sword of the king of Babylon shall come against you. I will cause your hordes to fall by the swords of mighty men, the most ruthless of all nations. They will shatter the pride of Egypt, and all her hordes will be overthrown. I will destroy all her cattle from beside abundant waters, no longer to be stirred by the foot of man or muddied by their hoofs. Then I will let her waters sink and make her streams flow quietly like oil, declares the sovereign Yahweh. 15. When I make Egypt desolate and strip the land of everything in it, when I strike down everybody who lives there, then they will know that I am Yahweh. Got a picture of what's going on? He's not happy with Pharaoh. These are some actions that are going to take place. 16. This is the poem of bereavement. They will chant for her. Okay, what do we start with? Chanting a poem. Here is the poem that will be chanted. The daughters of the nations will chant it. For Egypt and all her hordes, they will chant it. This is the end of that first part. Now the second part starts at verse 18 after the date, which is the 12th year, 15th day. So we're 15 days later. The next chant is 15 days later. Ezekiel says, the word of Yahweh came unto me saying, Son of man, wail for the hordes of Egypt, and speak this prediction, that they shall be cast down to the earth below, both her and the daughters of mighty nations, with those who have gone down to the pit. Talking about people who are dead. Say to them, as beautiful as thou art, thou art not more so than other nations, which nevertheless have perished and gone down to the netherworld, where all beauty is quickly lost. That's another word there. We can tie that in. 20. They will fall among those killed by the sword. The sword is drawn. Let her be dragged off to death with all her hordes. 21. From Sheol, the mighty elves. The Septuagint has the Greek word for giants. We won't discuss that at this time. From Sheol, the mighty elves will say to Egypt and her allies with a taunting welcome. Remember, this is a chant. This is a chant. A poem of bereavement being chanted by the daughters. From Sheol, the mighty elves will say to Egypt and her allies with a taunting welcome, they have come down, and they lie with the uncircumcised, with those killed by the sword. Okay, if we take this literally, this means that all the dead now arise and taunt Pharaoh coming in. The text is saying. 22. Assyria is there with her whole army. She is surrounded by the graves of all her slain, all who have fallen by the sword. We're going to go through a list of nations here. Whose graves are set in the sides of the pit. I'll come back to that. And her army lies around her grave. All who have spread terror in the land of the living, the slain, fallen by the sword. Now, sides of the pit. Archaeological digs have shown that they would cut out spaces in the side of a hill or the side of a mountain, and they would put in shells for people, and this is where they would put the bodies. And they found the bodies that way. And so this is the Hebrew text for that particular language. 24. Next nation. There is Elam, with all her hordes around her grave. All of them are slain, fallen by the sword. When they were alive, they spread terror in the land of the living. They went down uncircumcised to the nether parts of the earth below, bearing their disgrace with those who had already gone down to the pit. Earth below, pit. 25. A bed is made for her among the slain, with all her hordes around her grave. All of them are uncircumcised, killed by the sword. Because their terror had spread in the land of the living, they bear their shame with those who have already gone down to the pit. They are laid among the slain. Next nation, actually two. They're both there, with all their hordes around their graves. All of them are uncircumcised, killed by the sword, because they spread their terror in the land of the living. They shall not have separate tombs, such as mighty conquerors have. Let's talk about that. We're going to get into that a lot more when we talk about the Mesopotamic tomb rituals in Isaiah 14, which is our next parable we're going to look at. But let's just say here that, in a general sense, conquerors expected a really nice going-away ceremony with a nice tomb. And mourners who would talk about how great their deeds were and how wonderful they were and blah, blah, blah. All right? This is what they expected. That's not what they got. They shall not have separate tombs such as mighty conquerors have. A disgrace. That's a disgrace to a mighty conqueror who have gone down to Sheol. Talking about other mighty conquerors who have already gone down. So they're already dead. With their weapons of war. And whose swords were laid under their heads. What did they find in the archaeological digs? When they went through the land of Judah, looking at this particular century and a few other centuries around it, they found a number of places where the shells and where the bones were there, and there were swords and other things from battle armor that have been buried with the people, swords laid under their heads. But the punishment for their iniquity shall be upon their bones. We've talked about bones in Genesis just recently. Though the terror of these mighty ones was once in the land of the living. Just reiterating. Let's look at this passage again. Let's take out the parenthetical statements. They shall not have separate tombs, such as mighty conquerors have, who have already died, but the punishment for their iniquity shall be upon their bones. There'll be no embalming. There'll be no caretaking. But the worst that could be for a great one who has died, the worst is what they will have. 28. You too, O Pharaoh, will be broken and will lie among the uncircumcised with those killed by the sword. Let's continue with another kingdom. Edom, her kings and all her princes, notwithstanding their might, they shall be brought down by them that were slain by the sword. They will lie with the uncircumcised and with them to go down to the pit. Now, the problem with this one is that Edom, being a descendant of Isaac, probably understood circumcision. So really, to go down with the uncircumcised was even another bad thing. Now, that's just my speculation. Edom was descended from Isaac. I assume they understood circumcision. I don't know if they practiced it. Verse 30. All the princes of the north and all the Zidonians are there. They went down with the slain in disgrace, despite the terror which resulted from their might. Doesn't matter how mighty they are, they went down in disgrace. They lie uncircumcised with those killed by the sword and bear their shame with those who go down to the pit. It's a nice list here. 31. Pharaoh shall see them and shall be comforted at the knowledge of having other kingdom companions in his downfall. What does that make you think? Oh, Pharaoh will be awake after he's dead in Sheol, and he'll be watching all these other kings coming down to Sheol, and he will be comforted since misery loves company. That's what it's saying, right? If it were true. And 32, for I've caused my terror in the land of the living, and he shall be laid in the midst of the uncircumcised with them that are slain with the sword. Even Pharaoh and his multitude, declares the sovereign Yahweh. So here's that text. Once again, this is a chant of bereavement for an impending doom situation based on the use of the Hebrew word at the beginning of the text, and I think verse 18 where it's repeated. The whole idea here is he's going down. And I'm going to dress it up to make it as ugly as I can. Let's take a quick review. Yahweh instructs Ezekiel to chant a lamentation about the Pharaoh. Builds up how great Pharaoh is. Then he describes how we destroy him and its effect on the solar system. Now, I mean, you know, you got to think about back then. You talk about the solar system and all the stars being darkened. That was pretty impressive. It doesn't impress us, but it probably impressed them. Because of how great Pharaoh was, his fall shall cause others to be astonished, and their kings, Rahab, after recovering from that shock, will receive another as Yahweh flashes his sword in their face so they can anticipate what's coming to them. So, it's not looking good. That's why it's a chant of bereavement. The sword of the king of Babylon shall come against you, ruthless. I will cause your hordes to fall by the swords of mighty men. They will shatter the pride of Egypt. I will make Egypt desolate, strip the land of everything in it, and kill everybody there who's alive. Pretty thorough when you think about it. Pretty thorough here. I don't have any follow-up questions of what's going to happen to Egypt. Wail for the hordes of Egypt. As beautiful as thou art not more so than other nations, and they're all dead, and you can guess where they are. The mighty down there will say, metaphorically speaking, to Egypt and her allies, this taunting welcome. They've come down to lie with us uncircumcised. They say, Elam, Edom, Zidonians, Meshach, or something like that, Tubal, are already there. You too will be broken and go down to Sheol too. And then you will see them and you'll be comforted at the misery of everybody else. So here's a comparison of the text. Here's where the Sheol appears in the text. Here's where the grave appears in the text. And here's where the pit appears in the text. Some synonymous readings talking about the dead. We have seen two passages that talk about Sheol having a level of response. Sheol having a level of response. So what we have to understand is that do these two lamentation chants for the dead overturn all the evidence that we've seen for Sheol so far? This is a weight of evidence question, rhetorical. You can think about it as we move forward here. The dead are also said to be in the earth below. Okay, I want to talk about the word hell, which appeared in the KJV. I'm calling it the Old English. The word hellen means to conceal or cover. And helling of potatoes means putting them into pits in the ground. This is 1611, not today. We'll talk about etymology of this word later in this presentation. But right now I want you to understand that what we've been talking about in just these passages today, much less the passages before, is talking about putting these people into the ground, into the pits. So hell is the correct word if you lived in 1611. Confirmation of the certainty of deliverance from Babylon. This is another proverb found here. I think the word is mashal. I'd have to look it up. But it says, take up the proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the oppressor ceased? How has his boisterous behavior ceased? All right, we're going to walk through this. Then I'm going to share with you an overview of this text. What I want you to understand is, once again, Mesopotamia, kingdom, burial rituals, well-established, well-researched. We know what kings expected. Look at this from the standpoint of everything the king would expect, he gets the opposite. Consider that as we go through the text. Yahweh hath broken the staff of the wicked and the scepter of the rulers. He which in anger struck down people with unceasing blows and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. Doesn't sound like a nice nation. But he's down now. So the whole earth is at rest and quiet. And they break forth into singing. So is that what the king would expect at his death? That everybody be rejoicing? Where's the mourning? All right. 8. Even the cypress trees rejoice. Help me here. We're back to the trees again. The trees are rejoicing, and they speak, just like Judges 9. Since you were laid low, nobody's come and cut us down. There's a reason why that text is there. I'll give it to you after we finish this. 9. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you arrive. What do you think? If we were to look at this with no contextual understanding of the history of Mesopotamia and the kings and the funeral rituals, if we just skip the context and go straight to, wow, Sheol's awake and alive and doing well today. We come away with one meaning, but if you understand that these kings had an expectation in Sheol, when they died, they expected a certain event to take place, and the opposite is going to take place. And I'm going to cover that, okay? But I want you to just read the text first before I confuse you. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you arrive, and arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all those who were leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. And they all speak and say, ooh, you have become weak like us. You have become like us. Not what the king expected. All your pomp has been brought down to Sheol along with the music of your harps. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and the worms are your covering. Why is that in the text? Because their tombs, as have been excavated, have discovered certain things that they put in place to keep maggots and worms out. But the text is going to come against that and say, boy, this is the worst case scenario. Let's skip ahead to 18. All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. Think about it. You have a nation, you have a king. When the king dies, you get the big burial, you get the big ceremony. It's got the big, nice tomb. Could have people in there. He's probably got some food, probably got some, maybe a table and a shovel and whatever else you need to make it through the underworld. I don't know. You know, there's different things down there. Okay? And it's a great glory. Okay? Well, what about you? You've been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch. Worst case scenario. Your body's covered with the bodies of dead soldiers. You didn't even get a proper burial. With those pierced by the sword, those who descend to the stones of the pit, like a corpse trampled underfoot. Once again, corpse. They were into purity. The worst case scenario is to have a dead corpse lying over you. Right? So far, boisterous behavior ceases. They once were strong and become weak like the rest of the inhabitants. So the question is, did they really speak? Did everybody in Sheol rise up and welcome them and say, ha, 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 guess what? You're just like us, nothing. I have a tendency to think that that's not the case in this parable. All right, now let me read you a few thoughts concerning this that I wrote down that I just wanted to share. I didn't want to put it in the slide. Okay. The whole idea of this, we're dealing with Sargon. How many people know Sargon or heard of Sargon? When I bought my first computer in 1985, a Macintosh, I bought a chess program. It was called Sargon 3. At the time, I didn't know who Sargon was. But I always remember that chess program because it was good. Okay. It inverts the expected events for the laments of a king. So if we're going to lament a king, this is what is expected. Oh, but this is what you're going to get, says the Almighty. Rather than a catalog of the deceased strengths and achievements, there's a list of faults and grievances that have been suffered at the hands of this tyrant. So that is a reversal. Okay? You could call it a reversal of fortune. After his death, there's no mourning. Everybody breaks into song. The trees break into song. How happy are we that you are gone. Mesopotamia rulers had long boasted of cutting the cedars of Lebanon. Remember I told you, we come back to why it says cut down. This goes all the way back to the Gilgamesh tablets. You all are familiar with that because that is part of the Noahide story with the flood. All right, so there's a long history of this. By contrast, not only is the king mocked by the cedars, by the trees that he normally cut down, he himself is cut down. So part of the glory was cutting down the cedars. Instead, the cedars are rejoicing that you're gone and none of them are cut down. The reversal of fortune. Mocking him in relation to the prototype of all the people who went before, and we can call it a myth if you want, he had a level of expectancy to live up to. This is the level, this is the bar that's been drawn for you, O king. And your propaganda shows that this is how you are declaring yourself. The reality, you yourself got cut down and the trees are rejoicing. Worst case scenario. Now, that's what happens on the planet. Let's go down to Sheol. The king does not receive the greeting he would have personally expected from there. What is that greeting? Standard Mesopotamian royal rituals presents a case where in the underworld, all of the royal ancestors are summoned, they're awakened, they welcome you to set you into a place of honor in the underworld. That's how they understood it to take place. What does the parable say? The parable says, nope, you're here and you're weak just like us. You are nothing. Reversal of fortune. Continuing, Isaiah 14 plays with the idea of the body being buried properly. But what does Isaiah say? Nope. We're going to put corpses on top of your body. You're not even going to get a tomb. Once again, reversal of fortune. Okay, so the curse employs every possible negative result that could take place. That's what's happening in this particular parable. Okay, now the next thing, we're not covering verses 20 and 21, but I will tell you what it says. I wrote it out later. It says, prepare for his sons a slaughtering block so that the seed of the evildoers will never again be named. What is that talking about? How many people are here familiar with the second death? Well, you're not, because I'm going to tell you what the second death is for a Mesopotamian ruler. It is that your name is forgotten and nobody goes to your tomb and they don't provide you with the correct offerings and they're not tending to it. And if we can kill off all the kids of this line, then nobody is going to come take care of your tomb and you will have experienced the second death according to their mindset. And that is what is taking place in Isaiah 14. The worst possible case. Poor king. He's down. So, I'm not taking this parable particularly serious from the standpoint that when this particular king went down, Sargon, that everybody woke up and welcomed him down and said, you're nothing. And then they all went back to sleep. I'm not convinced that's what took place. I'm just saying. Moving on. Yeshua went to Sheol. We all know this. But his soul was not left there. Let's talk about it. Psalm 16:10. For thou wilt not leave my soul. If the soul never got there, it can't be left. That means it got there. But it won't be left there. Shows up in the Septuagint. Same text. But guess what word is translated from Sheol? The Greek word Hades. We're all familiar with that. Because we've all read Homer. All right. Acts 2:27 quotes this passage. Because thou wilt not leave my soul in Hades. So here, what are we learning? The Septuagint translators understood the original meaning of Hades to be the meaning of Sheol. We're going to have fun with that. All right. Continuing in Acts 2:30. David, being a prophet, knowing that God had sworn an oath, that of the fruit of his loins, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne. Seeing what was ahead, he spoke of the resurrection of Yeshua, that his soul was not going to be left in Hades or Sheol. One more passage. Hosea, tell me where you think you know this passage, if you've seen it before. From the hand of Sheol I do ransom thee. From death I redeem thee. Where is thy plague, O death? Where is thy destruction, O Sheol? Septuagint reading. From the hand of Hades I will save them and set them free from death. Where is thy penalty, O death? O Hades, where is thy sting? 1 Corinthians 15. All right. We'll be there one day. Final summary. Notwithstanding these three parables, which are clearly not to be completely as a whole understood literal, because I'm not going to buy that these trees are having these discussions at the literal level. Okay? That's me. We've got a working definition of Sheol and a working definition of Hades using the procedure of usage technique. And it is. It signifies the state of the dead in general without regard to the goodness or badness of a person with no activity or knowledge whatsoever. So let's break it down line by line. No compartments. No levels have been mentioned. No separations have been mentioned. There's no river to cross to get to the entrance. There's no fee to enter. Proper burial not required to arrive there. Those already there have no power to keep others out. There are no thoughts or expressions of emotion. No forms of communication unless Yahweh calls, notwithstanding our three parables. The spirit has departed and is back with God. Mankind lies in Sheol until the heavens be no more. I just took some of the high points. I didn't cover all of them. So now, what's next? Patriarchal alert. We're missing a patriarch. If you think you know who that patriarch is, do not shout it out, but you can raise your hand. Do you think you know who the patriarch is who's missing? I will tell you. Abraham's missing. There's been no mention of him being alive in any sense, including welcoming believers. There's no mention of paradise so far in any Hebrew text that we have seen. There's no mention of a blissful state of the righteous after they arrive. There's no mention of torture of the unrighteous after they arrive. We haven't found it. Not in that text. Now, we found plenty of it in the classics. But in this collection of texts, you can call it the Old Testament, the Septuagint, Torah writings and prophets. You can probably come up with another name. In that collection of texts, that is true. Question is, how much value does that have for you? Ooh, that rhymed. Okay, continuing. Moving forward, Hebrew Scriptures, we are done with Sheol. Hades. Hades, did you know that Hades got an extreme makeover? When it started out in Homer, you read it. You saw the text. You saw that it was just like Sheol. By the time we got to the first century, it was a party. And for those of you who have already started your reading assignment in 1 Enoch, you're already seeing what's going on. All right. What's the etymology of hell? In 1611, hell meant to conceal or cover or put something into the pit in the ground. So hell is correct in 1611. So let's have some history of translation. Sometimes Sheol is translated as hell. Sometimes Hades is translated as hell, but it literally means an unseen place. The Latin infernum means to refer to the lower regions. The Italian inferno means the underworld. This is all 1611, just so you all know. So, with that history of translation, we need to understand etymology, that this word means this now. But 400 years later, it means this. I want to build my doctrine on this new meaning 400 years later and twist everything else up in the process. Danger, Will Robinson. I'm just saying, the text that we read, Abraham's missing. This is a cause for concern. Homework assignment for session 5. We're going to be reading intertestamental literature. Here's what you'll be reading. I will make sure you have copies of all of this. First Enoch, I've already told you about. Second Baruch, the Wisdom of Solomon, the Testament of Abraham. Fourth Ezra, 2 and 4 Maccabees, Philo and Josephus. I'll be quoting from every one of these writings to talk about what happened between the closing of the Old Testament canon and the beginning of the time of Yeshua, so that you can see what has taken place. The end.